We're getting lucky up front.
This is The Lonely Voice with Peter Orner from Texas Public Radio. I'm Yvette Benavides. On this episode, Peter Orner and I discuss Fun with a Stranger by Richard Yates. As with our previous episode, we're talking about a school story with a teacher and her third grade class. Last time, William Maxwell's Love helped us see the ways a protagonist learned a lesson about love through his fifth grade teacher, Miss Vera Brown. He learned about love that it blooms in beautiful and unforgettable ways. Miss Brown was pretty, gentle, and compassionate. The protagonist feels a kind of love from her and for her. This time, in Fun with a Stranger by Richard Yates, we see another teacher, Miss Snell, who might seem to be the polar opposite of Miss Brown. Miss Snell isn't all that lovable. She's an older woman who's described as having a homely smile and mannish features. She's also tough on her students, even keeping to the regular school day schedule on the last day before the Christmas holiday. But there are other lessons to be learned in this story, too, about love and compassion. Yates is known as presenting characters in all too real ways that we might interpret as cruel, perhaps. Not all teachers are physically attractive. Not all of them are good at throwing little parties or choosing gifts for young children. Miss Snell is set in her ways. She's doing what she knows how to do and is just who she is, despite what day in December it might be. And she is as unforgettable as Miss Vera Brown. Miss Brown was isolated from her students at the end, and she died alone. Miss Snell seems to go through her life alone, but her kind of loneliness is something quite else. And it's only a writer like Richard Yates who could compose the stories in the story collection 11 Kinds of Loneliness and even begin to understand and create the taxonomy of people bereft of love or of friendship or even of a kind of kinship with the itinerant group of third graders who want to forget about Miss Snell over Christmas or after the third grade. She'll make an indelible imprint and remain almost like a word in their vocabulary, part of the language they will always speak. And that's just the way it is with words, as Miss Snell said. Here now, Peter Orner and I discuss Fun with a Stranger by Richard Yates. Fun with a Stranger.
Yeah.
So what do you think about this story?
You know, it's a classic. You know, it's deceptive. When I was first rereading it, I was like, this is a great story, but it isn't, you know. I mean, Yates has written better, you know. But then when I reread it, I sort of argued with that point. And there's something, I don't know, I don't want to get technical so fast because you're the one who chose this one. And so you should tell me. But I'll say one thing is like, there's something about the point of view, which I don't like to dwell on, you know, I just like to accept. But there's something so intimate about it. And if you like remember this story later, you know, years from now, you might think it was written in the first person, but it's not. And that's nothing, I guess, nothing revelatory. But, you know, he certainly wasn't the only person to do this kind of stuff. But there's just something so like you're in that room completely through the eyes of those kids. And yet we don't have a kid telling us this story. I don't know if that's even important.
I think it's very important because when I reread it recently, I had to go back and say, oh, well, wait a minute. Was the narrator a student? I mean, I really had to go back and think about first person and this sort of omniscient narrator that, as you say, works so intimately and so closely that, yeah, that there's this moment where you have to go back and just double check. I know it's sort of like this idea with short stories that this sort of omniscient narration is so passé, you know, it's just something from of the past now. But I think the way Yates does it, we can just agree that it could just well be, if not somebody who was there somehow, then it's us. You know, I just feel like the narrator just captures things that we understand And we weren't there either, right? So does that make sense? I know that sounds so wonky, but...
Yeah. I mean, it does, but yeah, we're getting wonky up front and totally, you know, like, I mean, but yeah, I think that that's it. And, you know, it does, yeah, it seems like something like, okay, it's been done before. And A, why are we talking about it? And B, it sounds like we're in like some creative writing workshop, which is, I guess we both have experience with that, unfortunately. But, you know, like it's a killer. It's a way to kill talking about a story.
You know what I mean?
That's why I didn't even want to bring it up.
But, sorry.
But no. But that's the point, is that what you're saying is like, it does feel like we are there. And that is not something to be taken for granted.
It's not something to be taken for granted, because you enter the story and you say, oh, yeah, they're great, whatever. But then he makes it new in the telling. And I have had this thing about Miss Snell lately, and it's something that we talked about with the story Love, with the Maxwell story, the last episode, about the sort of the mythology of teachers and of grades. End of classes, and how we hype things up, or how we hype them up in our nostalgia, in our looking back. But with this story, I feel like the brutal honesty around the characterization of Miss Snell, I'm very sympathetic to Miss Snell now.
Nobody reading this story couldn't be, and that's the miracle of it, you know. And I can we strike that word? I shouldn't be using that word so much, you know. I feel like every story is a miracle lately, but yeah, totally. I mean, who hasn't, like, and we should get into it. And I want to ask you, like, why you chose it, but can I just say one thing? And that is, like, who hasn't been in the situation where you are with the unpopular teacher and across the hall, the other kids have the popular teacher? And it's almost like you can't help but feel something for the unpopular teacher who, in this case, has done everything in her power to make herself unpopular. And yet, you know, that's your class and that's who you are. And there's a line later on, you know, sort of towards the beginning of the story where it says, when she said something like that, and we have to get to what she says because it's amazing. The dialogue is incredible here. When she said something like that, it was more embarrassing than anything else, but it did leave the children with a certain vague sense of responsibility towards her, and often prompted them into a loyal reticence when children from other classes demanded to know how bad she really was. Well, not too bad, they would say uncomfortably, and try to change the subject. There's a lot of stories about teachers and kids out there. I don't think I've ever kind of seen it articulated quite so accurately and beautifully and sympathetically in a character that has done everything possible to be unsympathetic. Why did you choose this story?
I was very interested in locating as many teacher stories as I could.
Cool.
And Yeats has them. The thing about this story is it's a little bit of a moving target for me. I do want to answer your question a little bit more clearly, but there's this idea connected to what you just said about Miss Snell, and it's in the collected stories. It's at the bottom of page 86. He says, still, they could not hate Miss Snell, for children's villains must be all black, and there was no denying that Miss Snell was sometimes nice in an awkward, groping way of her own. That comes before the part that you just read. But I have to say that in the last few readings of the story, I was really paying attention to that idea and the idea of what the narrator is presenting to us, how the children are responding to her, how the children respond to the prettier, younger Mrs. Cleary, and looking at it from the standpoint of how there are so many people in our lives who are villains who are not all bad, who are villains who are just doing the best that they can. And I feel like Miss Snell is just who she is. And there's a lesson for me, just as a reader, my whole life, even at this age, but even when I was younger, my whole life about characters who are just who they are And it's not that she's a flat, one-dimensional character incapable of change, because we do even see the needle move a little bit in the story. So no character who is like Miss Snell is just this, as she's described in places in the story, this flat, nothing, nobody character that people don't pay attention to, and she's just invisible, and who cares? Because she doesn't put her hands in her pockets in a jaunty way, you know? And maybe she's not pretty. She is very much alive and present and even cares in her own, as it says, awkward, groping way. So there's this dimensionality about this character that in this latest round of readings for me has been so, I don't know, important. I don't know what to call it, but it just has made the story so new for me to consider her in this way. And yes, I have had my share of teachers who are, as you said, you know, we're sort of looking longingly across the hall to the other teacher. She seemed like more fun and just like a cool person compared to this, you know, what does he call her? How does he describe her? You know, Oh, here it is. It's right at the beginning. She was probably 60, a big, raw-boned woman with a man's face. And her clothes, if not her very pores, seemed always to exude that dry essence of pencil shavings and chalk dust that is the smell of school. She was strict and humorless, preoccupied with rooting out the things she held intolerable, mumbling, slumping, daydreaming, frequent trips to the bathroom, and the worst of all, coming to school without proper supplies. Her small eyes were sharp, and when somebody sent out a stealthy alarm of whispers and nudges to try to borrow a pencil from somebody else, it almost never worked. "What's the trouble back there?" she would demand. "I mean you, John Gerhart," and John Gerhart or Howard White or whoever it happened to be, caught in the middle of a whisper, could only turn red and say, "Nothing." "Don't mumble. Is it a pencil?" But, you know, but this raw-boned face of a man, you know, it's merciless, the description. What the narrator is giving to us, it's very interesting that the narrator is giving it to us this way because of what we've already said about the narrator. But I just feel like it has to do with our perspective when we're in the third grade and we want the fun, cool, young, jaunty teacher who gives nice gifts and has a great Christmas party compared to this, you know, other kind of practical older person. It's a lesson about how we do this to people in general.
I think what you say of your description of Yeats being merciless is so accurate. It was a merciless guy. And maybe it's worth just maybe stepping a little bit back and saying that this story is from a collection called 11 Kinds of Loneliness, which I believe was published originally in the late 40s, early 50s, right?
I think the story was written in the early 50s, this particular one.
So 55 for Fun with a Stranger, when it originally appeared. And then the book itself was somewhat time after that, so 50s. There's a beautiful quote of Vonnegut where he talks about this being, Vonnegut says it's one of the 10 best story collections ever written by an American. And the New York Times at that time called it, you know, New York's Dubliners. And, you know, I think there's some truth in that. Every story in this book has this merciless quality to it. No one is safe. Usually, especially the narrators, but nobody. No, there's no angels and there's no devils, you know, in his work. I think everybody is this weird combination of both. A lot of devils, you know, but there's kindness too. There's kindness in Yeats. There's almost merciless kindness also in some ways. And so I don't know. This is I just rereading it at your suggestion. I just thought Yeah, I'd sort of miss seen it as kind of like, oh, it's a solid story about being a third grader and having not the young, beautiful teacher, but the really strict one. I mean, my own kid right now has the Mrs. Clary version, the nice teacher right now. And I notice it. I notice it at school pickups. I notice the sort of euphoria of his class versus, and I shouldn't, you know, say this publicly. So, I mean, I'm sure all the teachers are great, right? But he definitely has the teacher that is sort of, you know, really, really connects with the kids. And that is a wonderful thing, but what if you're not in that class, you know? And I'm spinning. I'm not saying anything.
No, you definitely are, because I've heard you talk about Yeats's, I don't want to say brutality, but how ruthless he can be and how kind he can be. And it made me flip over to the introduction by Richard Rousseau, where he says Yeats's characters not only don't understand the source of their own desires, they undervalue their own strengths and virtues, discounting their kindness and decency as if they can't quite imagine that these qualities will get them anywhere in life, nor do they recognize true worth in others. Miss Snell, the grade school teacher in Fun with a Stranger, offers each of her students a perfect gift of love in the form of an eraser, something they'll badly need in their mistake-filled adult lives. But her gift is unwanted by children too young to understand its nature or meaning. Yeats writes brilliantly. Oh no, you're going to disagree?
I'm going to disagree, sorry.
Wait, no, let me get this out while I blow my nose.
Respect to Richard Rousseau. It's beautiful. Go on, sorry.
You hold that thought. Yeats writes brilliantly about children in many of these stories. He does. Partly, it seems to me, because he understands that in important ways, most of us remain children all our lives, perpetually attracted to all the wrong things, taken in repeatedly by whatever is cheap and eye-catching and superficial.
I don't disagree with that part.
But I want to hear what you have to say about what I just read.
It's a beautiful introduction, and I am incredibly grateful for it. I'm incredibly grateful for Rousseau and others who helped bring Yeats back to us, you know, after being, you know, pretty forgotten. I mean, Revolutionary Road was a big book in its time. People knew of it, but the stories were long buried by, you know, years and years and not even anthologized. And so when that collected came out, it was a huge deal. You know, shout out to my editor at Little Brown, Josh Kendall, who had a lot to do with bringing this book back. So the only thing I would take issue with is the idea, and you're going to laugh at me, but come on, man, those erasers are not a gift of love. I think that's a really generous, a generous misread.
Except,
of her.
I'm sorry to interrupt. I'm sorry.
Sorry to be a jerk.
No, there's a Chekhovian eraser right at the beginning. You know, she is imparting to them how important it is. And I've had this one. Guess how long I've had this eraser? It's very important to her for whatever reason, right? And that's what she gives them.
I hear you. From her point of view, and if that's what he's saying, fair enough. But if I'm the kid, maybe I'm off here. And I probably am, I'm sure. But yeah, I just think like, you know, I mean, even Mrs. Snell knows. She knows that, you know, you could have given him a piece of candy or something, a piece of licorice.
She knows. She knows, but she's just who she is. Can you indulge me so I can read one more little section of this intro?
Yes.
He says,
yes.
If the reason we're pulled into Richard Yeats's story so quickly has to do with our understanding of what his characters so desperately desire, what often keeps us turning pages is the more gradual revelation of those same characters' anxieties. The most primal of these, it seems, is loneliness, the fear of which causes the people in Yeats's stories to endure terrible humiliations. And it goes on, but that's true. If we say she knows the erasers are not a great gift for a third grade student at Christmas. But she's going to endure whatever response because she's just who she is. I don't know. Yeah. Maybe that's a story.
No, I think it's what you said earlier. Like, she is who she is. And that, I'm not objecting to the fact that she gives the erasers. I'm just objecting to the fact that that it would be construed as like a missed opportunity to see the love. I'm not sure I read that in it. I think in spite of the fact that A, she should have known, and B, they don't really represent much else to me other than just kind of somebody who's just a little nuts. The point is that now, retrospectively, thinking back, we all fall in love with Mrs. Snell. Rousseau is 100% right. This is about the loneliness of remembering her. Kind of one of the beauties of the when 11 Kinds of Loneliness, which was published by Vintage in the 80s, republished, you know, it has 11 stories. And the title is 11 Kinds of Loneliness. And it's just so perfect. You know, because each story, you know, arguably is sort of like a certain kind. And here it's the loneliness of somebody who you in spite of yourself, you mourn, I think, when you're older. And that's how I see the story. Even though there's no indication that anyone's remembering this other than that weird narration and that weird voice and that point of view thing we talked about at the beginning.
You know what I love about this story is how he uses John and Howard from Miss Snell's class to be this pair. These two, so there's not one kind of solitary student sort of experiencing Miss Snell. It's like the two boys are together when Freddie Taylor and his twin sister Grace from Miss Cleary's class. So there's another twosome. So
right.
They're not alone. So I like this idea that, you know, these two boys are from Miss Snell's class and they're sort of in this even, you know, sort of pitched battle with two students from the other class. They happen to be, boy-girl twins. I like that there's not like, except for maybe Alice Johnson, you know, who suffers a little bit in the story because...
Mumbles.
She mumbles and Miss Snell humiliates her, but... There's just something for me about this idea of, and that's so also so real. I mean, I think that the two boys are experiencing Miss Snell, but I feel like they are still very much alone in how they experience Miss Snell. Howard is alone, and the other kid, John, is alone. I don't know. I feel like they're going through it together, but they're very much alone in how they are experiencing it because of the way that they also imagine what the gifts could possibly be. The gifts were all wrapped alike in white tissue paper with red ribbon, and the few whose individual shapes John Gerhardt could discern looked like they might be jackknives. Maybe it would be jackknives for the boys, he thought, and little pocket flashlights for the girls. This part breaks my heart a little. Or more likely, since jackknives were probably too expensive, it would be something well-meant and useless from the dime store, like individual lead soldiers for the boys and miniature dolls for the girls. But even that would be good enough. Something hard and bright to prove that she was human after all, to pull out of a pocket and casually display to the Taylor twins. Well, no, not a party exactly, but she gave us all these little presents. Look.
To be really geeky, we don't even hear who, it doesn't even matter which, if it's John or Howard that says that.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter. You know, it's in parentheses and it's in quotations and it's a, God, I mean.
So we didn't set it up this time. We're just geeking out from the word go and it's okay.
I think anybody still with us would realize what's happening, right? You know, in third grade, you got this teacher who's awful. And she gives them erasers instead of the jackknives.
And the very genius way of setting up the contrast between the two teachers in the same place, which was this field trip, and we can see them both in action together and apart. And I just thought, you know, they're in their own separate realms. They're with the door closed in the classrooms, but in the field trip, everybody gets to see, both groups get to see both teachers. And, you know, Miss Snell does not fare well. in that competition, that sort of implicit competition. And, you know, I don't know. It's just such a great story. I don't know. There were moments when I was reading it this last time yesterday when I thought, I don't know if Peter likes this story. I wonder if Peter loves this story. And I could see that there are elements of it that you might not be gaga about.
I mean, that's why I was saying, like, you know, if I was to pick a story to talk about from 11 Kinds of Loneliness, it might not be this one. It'd be Builders, or it would be the Jack-O-Lantern one. I forget the name, or Glutton for Punishment. But again, it reminds you that, you know, that, I don't know, what does it remind you? It's just how when somebody is good, maybe you don't always need their best. You know, maybe that's it. Like, we've done one Yeats story on here, Oh Joseph, I'm So Tired, which is extraordinary, right? A later story. I forget when that was, probably written in the 60s. But even when somebody maybe isn't working at the very highest level, there's a buildup, you know, that's important to look at. And so, you know, the art of putting together a story collection, you know, you can't learn enough from it, from this book. I don't know what I'm trying to say, but you know what I mean? Like, this,
yeah.
You know, Fun with the Stranger is, you know, is essential to this book, even though for me, it might not be the story I reach for. But then when I slow down and at your suggestion reread it after all these years, then, you know, a line like this is about Miss Cleary. The most tedious facts about trains came alive when she explained them. The most forbidding engineers and switchmen became jovial hosts when she smiled up at them with her long hair blowing and her hands plunged jauntily in the pockets of her polo coat. Like you pointed out that jauntily earlier, like that completely captures her. And the story's not a love letter to Mrs. Cleary, but he can't help but express how delightful this teacher was. And, you know, thinking back to the Maxwell, like, that's Mrs. Cleary. You know, Maxwell was in Mrs. Cleary's class, you know. But Yeats, which is so Yeatsian, was, of course, he would be in Mrs. Snell's.
This thing about the title, in the story it says, this is Miss Snell. When we learn a new word, it's like making a friend, she said once. And we all like to make friends, don't we? Now, for instance, when school began this year, you were all strangers to me, but I wanted very much to learn your names and remember your faces, and so I made the effort. It was confusing at first, but before long, I'd made friends with all of you, and later on, we'll have some good times together. Oh, perhaps a little party at Christmas time or something like that. And then I know I'd be very sorry if I hadn't made that effort, because you can't very well have fun with a stranger. Can you? She gave them a homely, shy smile, and that's just the way it is with words. So it's sort of like at the beginning of the school year or thereabouts, she's already predicting that by Christmas time, you know, they will have had so much fun. And I think this idea of making friends with them, that they're no longer strangers just by virtue of the fact that she's their teacher, is something a lonely person would say, I think, to a room full of children. And I think about, you know, this idea of she could anticipate that by December, that somehow their relationship would have morphed. But of course, it really didn't. Or do you think it did?
No, I mean, I think you're right. I just think what you just read, that dialogue, which is basically a long speech, you know, is so heartbreaking. I mean, anyone hearing that would understand what we're talking about in this story and why we're doing it.
Yes.
You know?
When she said something like that, it was more embarrassing than anything else but it did leave the children with a certain vague sense of responsibility toward her and often prompted them into a loyal reticence when children from other classes demanded to know how bad she really was. Well, not too bad, they would say uncomfortably and try to change the subject. When I read that part, I think about how many times we feel that way about anything in our lives, about other things in our lives, not just our teacher, but the things that are not quite what others expect or not quite what even we want or expect. And we have to defend it. That happens all the time. It's beautiful to see it in writing.
It is. I mean, and that's Yeats. Even just there's a even a tiny note like, and then I'd know I'd be very sorry if I hadn't made that effort, because you can't very well have fun with a stranger, can you? That even the repetition of very there is so kind of like, you know, somebody else might edit that out, but he is like listening so carefully to her pathetic speech, which is also beautiful in memory. And even at the time, they can't help it. It's kind of ridiculous, but it isn't, you know? And like, it was confusing at first, but before long, I'd made friends with all of you, which she hasn't done, right? You know? And later on, we'll have some good times together. Oh, perhaps a little party at Christmas time or something like that. And she drops that bomb. And of course, the end of the story, which is this sustained 3-page scene, takes up almost half the story, which is the last day where they're waiting to see, you know, what this Christmas party is going to be like. And they have a regular day, totally regular school day, while the other class is blowing up with a party. But on her desk are these pile of very carefully wrapped gifts. All right, Grace took another bite of her cake and turned to, that's not important there.
No, it actually is. Can you read where it says Little Grace
I mean,
Taylor?
Grace kind of wanders in and says, you know, Mrs. Cleary wants to know if you have any extra plates. And this really pisses Mrs. Snell off. Miss Snell off. I have no paper plates, Miss Snell said. And will you kindly inform Mrs. Cleary that this class is in session? Now, we don't get any open conflict at all between Mrs. Cleary on the field trip or anything, but here, yeah, she's willing to actually say, like, look, get out of here with your cupcake, kid. You know, we don't have any extra plates. We are doing class now. Grace doesn't leave right away. And so Mrs. Snell says, you're holding up the class, Mrs. Snell said. Grace moved on. At the door, she gave the class a sly glance and a quick silent giggle full of cake crumbs. So, you know,
I mean,
I
she didn't
yeah.
just wander in and say, Mrs. Cleary wants to know if you have any paper plates. She's chomping on that beautiful, delicious, fun cupcake.
And, you know, I mean, Yeats, you know, I don't want to get into this mode of, you know what I mean, of, and I was criticizing creative writing class earlier, and it is what I do, you know, and I do love my students, and I love to teach what I teach, but like, how do you teach this except to just say, like, pay attention? And Yeats was so attentive to his people. And what they're doing, and it's so basic but so hard. And you know, my own teacher, you know, dear friend Andre Debuse was, and I think I've mentioned this before on this show, but was Yeats was his teacher, and Andre has a beautiful essay in, I believe it's from Meditations from a Movable Chair, where he it's a about a page and a half where he says, and it starts out. I think of your mornings, Dick. And he's imagining Yeats writing, you know. And I don't even remember exactly what he says, but just I love that idea of just thinking about Yeats in this quiet, you know, Yeats had a rough life. He drank way too much. He died, I think, you know, if not in poverty, pretty close to it, in a fairly squalid apartment in Boston, in my understanding. From my recollection. So, you know, even though he had some success in his life and was revered, you know, it was rough. And I love that tribute to him that even probably to the very end, he was still trying to do this, which was, you know, just pay attention to his characters.
I love what you said about it. I think you said it's so basic, but that's the hard stuff. That's the harder stuff to write, to make it look like it's just this little detail about the student that wanders in and asks for the paper plates. But you know, Miss Snell, it is the last day before the Christmas holiday. Miss Snell is well aware of what's going on across. She has to know what's going on across the way. And she still waits and keeps the regular class day for as long as she can. And she doesn't have all the things that Miss Cleary does. Maybe she just doesn't even have the wherewithal to do that for these young people. Some people don't work that way, operate yep. that way, think in those terms. And I just feel like it's so interesting that at least in this, in the story that we're getting, and I don't even know what I mean by that, but the narrator's version of the story is that she waited till, you know, the bitter end and then gave them this, you know, super practical gift that you know, it's not what they were expecting. Then, you know, at the end, Miss Snell, when she's offering them the presents, they started down the aisle reading the labels and passing out the gifts. The labels were the familiar Woolworth kind with a picture of Santa Claus and Merry Christmas printed on them. This goes to what you were saying about pay attention, the idea of the familiar Woolworth kind. Like, it wasn't anything special. It was probably the kinds of tags that the children had on the gifts from their parents or something.
Right.
John Gerhardt's read, "To John G. from Miss Snell." He picked it up, but the moment he felt the package, he knew, with a little shock, exactly what it was. There was no surprise left by the time Miss Snell returned to the head of the class and said, "All right." And then they can open them. He peeled off the paper and laid the gift on his desk. It was an eraser, the serviceable 10-cent kind, half white for pencil and half gray for ink. From the corner of his eye, he saw that Howard White, beside him, was unwrapping an identical one, and a furtive glance around the room confirmed that all the gifts had been the same. Nobody knew what to do, and for what seemed a full minute, the room was silent, except for the dwindling rustle of tissue paper. Miss Snell stood at the head of the class, her clasped fingers writhing like dry worms at her waist. Her face melted into the soft, tremulous smile of a giver. She looked completely helpless. Richard Yates is the author of Fun with a Stranger. This has been The Lonely Voice with Peter Orner from Texas Public Radio. Jacob Rosati composed our theme music. Dan Katz is Texas Public Radio's news director. I'm Yvette Benavides.